Welcome back to Kin Folklore. We decided to do a mini-season to cover Lovecraft Country. The show explores monstrous aspects of complex themes of racism, gender, and you know what? There's real monsters too, Andrew.
Yeah. Lovecraft Country is based on a book by Matt Ruff, inspired by the horror stories of H.P. Lovecraft, who wrote in the early half of the 20th century and explored humanity's place in the universe. But he was also a notable racist, obsessed with otherness, often using racist tropes. Today, we will be discussing the last five episodes of the show. When we last left Tick, Letty, and the gang, Tick was reading through Titus's lost pages, and he makes a phone call to a mysterious woman who tells him he should have never gone home.
And kinfolk, you have not even become one with the darkness yet. And before you do, I want you to know that Kin Folklore will have adult content. So don't be a one-pump chump. If you listen to the last episode, you'll be just fine. So let's dig into it with episode 6, Meet Me in Daegu, which is a play off of a Judy Garland movie called Meet Me in St. Louis. So we'll see why in a minute, but this episode takes us a bit out of the main story to South Korea in 1949. We meet Jaya, who is a young nurse who adores American films, especially the film Meet Me in St. Louis, and has a big secret that she's keeping. In addition to having a complicated relationship with her mother, she's also a kamihu, a nine-tailed fox spirit that is summoned into form of a beautiful woman to avenge the wrong done by men. The wrongdoing here in this case is her stepfather's abuse, which her mother did little to prevent and traumatized Jia. Her mother makes a deal with the shaman to summon a kamihu in exchange for her daughter and is replaced by the kamihu spirit. Her daughter's spirit is replaced by the kamihu. Jia must bring home 100 men to kill them. She lures them into her bedroom, has sex with them, and at that point, her tails or tentacles form from all of the orifices of her body and kill them during the act of sex.
Not a good look.
No.
Not a fun date.
It's a fucking messy cleanup too. Like every single time, it's like her, you know, Uma's in there. She's like, you know, scrubbing, and yes, you need to bring four more. I'm like, you really want to do this four more times? Shit, it's messy. Anyway, when these tentacles connect, Jaya sees a lifetime of memories. Right, she's able to also check out, like, you know, see like what the person has lived through up to the moment of their death. So Gia's mother believes that in exchange for the lives of the 100 men that, you know, based on the deal that she makes, she really believes that her daughter will return after the kamihu spirit that's living inside of her daughter kills the 100th man. At that point, the Americans arrive purporting to save Korea from the communists, and the brutality of the American forces are felt pretty much instantaneously. Suspected communists are executed, including one of Gia's friends. And this is where we see Tick, who comes into the story as serving in the army. Tick is the one who kills one of the nurses as they're being questioned about being spies for the communist army. You see Tick in a different light in this moment. You see that he does that literally without any emotion. So Tick is wounded later in this war, and Jia contemplates her revenge. He will be the 100th life. After kind of saying that she didn't want to take an 100th life, she's decided now that she's going to get her revenge and kill Tick. But as fate would have it, the two of them start to connect over Montrose's favorite book, The Count of Monte Cristo, and, you know, the difference between the book to the film, which Gia obviously has only seen the film. You know, probably to all you TV show watchers, read the books. The books are good. Read them. It's a good time. They have some differences. And they fall in love. Realizing she doesn't want to go through with killing him, Gia rejects Tick later on as they're about to have sex for the first time. She comes back and basically comes clean to him about her revenge plan. And when the two reconcile, they kind of talk about this idea of not being the monsters, but being the heroes, being able to redefine themselves, even though people in the world or view them as monsters, or they viewed each other as monsters. During their second attempt, the first attempt goes
well.
Kind of well.
How does the first attempt go?
I mean, My guy Tick struck. He needs to. This is his first time. Okay,
it is his first and time. Need, but we see it, later with Letty. He struggles a little bit.
But you know what? He's never good on the first attempt. The second attempt, it was so good with Gia that it started, like, you know, all of the Camijo tail started coming out because she was feeling it. And then, you know, him and Letty, same thing. So he needs a build up. This is what I'm starting to find out with, you know, first attempt. He's like a, hey, can we go again in a couple of minutes, guy? That's okay. It happens. You know, we're not going to blame him.
Yeah, but that's true. That's fair.
Anyway, this guy, definitely not so good on the first time, but on the second attempt does well enough that the Camijo tails tried to take Tick out, even though she doesn't want them to. She's trying to stop them, and they attach the Tick, and in that moment she sees his past and sees his future, which is a new kind of wrinkle, because to be honest, the reason why that kind of is interesting is that normally she only sees the past up to the point that she's about to kill them, but because she's not trying to kill Tick, she's actually able to see the future of what's going to happen to him also, knowing that he's going to go on beyond this point. As Tick tries to escape, she tells him not to go home, that he will die. Easily to see how Tick would think that maybe she's saying that she's going to kill him in that moment, as I rewatched it.
Yeah, I mean, Tick has every right to be horrified, scared. Like, she did just try to kill him.
Yeah.
After telling him that her plan was to kill him.
Yeah, exactly. It's super wild. So Gia's the one that we've been hearing on the other end of the line of the phone, basically telling him that he should not have went home. So it's obvious that Tick is still in contact with her, right? Sporadically, but still enough, right? So Gia and her mother return to the shaman, who tells her, as she's asking about whether Atticus will die, that you have not even become one with the darkness yet, which will be important later on. You will see countless deaths before the journey is done. So the things we kind of see in this episode are these ideas around humanity and versus monsters, the idea of otherness, oppressed people doing the work of white supremacy and colonization. And, you know, let's discuss for a moment the Korean War. You know, the Korean War was the first major war that black soldiers were integrated into the military units, right? They normally were just all black units, all white units. And so this is the first time that you see an integrated military force. Given the violence that we've watched Tick and his family face at the hands of a lot of the white racists in our country and what's happened here, it's jarring to see Tick use the violence that we see, right? You know, like the coldness in him when he mm-hmm. comes up and just shoots that woman in the head.
And follows orders without, I mean, I'm not judging people in the military for following orders, but the coldness in which he follows the order and just executes this woman is horrible.
Without questioning. Like, he didn't, no questioning. Yeah, it is horrible. And it's, you know, and neither one of the people killed had anything to do with what they were looking for. So they're killing people needlessly. Like, it wasn't even like, hey, let's figure out who it is before we go and do, I mean, I'm not down with torture anyway, but
yeah, they use it as a fear tactic.
Yeah, 100%. So it's kind of concerning to see Tick in that light. The show also is asking questions about humanity, right? Gia's mother asserts that Gia is a monster who can't feel anything because she is inhabited by a Camus, right? So she's saying, you're not going to be able to love. You can't have any of these emotions that you feel. But it's not true. Like, she appears, in the beginning, we see her as a very relatable person. And certainly we see her as
certainly
human.
Related to her singing along with a musical.
Yeah.
I was connected to Gia immediately.
Listen, I loved it. I loved her dance montage in her head that happened in the theater. Like, I'm thinking she really gets up. She's chilling in the theater. It's great. It's freaking awesome. Yeah, I'm with you.
And I think she's also capable of feeling loneliness. Like, Gia has feelings, right? We know that. But her mother doesn't connect to her the same way she did with her daughter. So I think that, you know, there's something there in Gia. Obviously, she falls in love. But she's still not the same person that she was before the Camille.
Yeah, but she also doesn't just, the thing is, she doesn't just fall in love. She also, like, makes, like, she feels love that is both romantic and otherwise. She actually mm-hmm. loves, even though Uma doesn't reciprocate, you can tell there's parts of her that loves her as well, right? Mm-hmm, and there's parts mm-hmm. of her that loves her friend. That's why she's so upset with Tick for what she knows they did to her. And to feel like that scene between her and her friend who says, you know, like, there's nothing wrong with being different. There's like, you know, the only thing is people making us feel bad for being different. And that, you know, that if they just look closer, they would see that we're all human. And for her to recognize, even though she doesn't realize in that moment, her friend, that she's recognizing that that's touching her on multiple levels, not just about being different, but saying that she recognizes her as being human, even though she knows that, you know, Gia knows she's not typically. It's really touching, and it's something that we can all take away from it, right? Like seeing the humanity in all in each other, right? It's really mm-hmm. it's a beautiful sentiment. That's a big theme in this. You know, we see that she can love and is capable of love, and she's capable of, you know, great suffering. She can feel pain, and this is just a constant reminder, right, of our humanity. And I love that Gia is struggling and grappling with these things, and the perception that we have of people, like, you know, there's this battle in a country that was won, that's now been separated, that we'll talk a little bit more about. There's this battle that's happening in just the perception of how people view each other based on a title, you know, capitalist, communist, monster, human. These things are being used to draw these comparisons. And then enters this idea of Judy Garland in Gia. And it's kind of a metaphor, Judy Garland's story, which we'll talk more about later on at the end, like what they that quote that happens and where that came from. But it's kind of like a metaphor for Tick and Gia and how they feel stuck in this machine. Judy Garland as a person, it's always been said, felt stuck in the machine of Hollywood. And she was perceived so, like, by some really lovingly and great, and some people wrote terrible things about her. She struggled with that her whole entire life, of the perception of others. She wrote about it in memoirs and things like that. And they keep grabbing this theme of why pick Judy Garland in this moment? Why pick those musicals? It's not just about the colonization. It's about the person they chose, who also, like Tick and Gia, are stuck in the machinery of these nations and the military and magic. And they actually want to feel something different. They're actually far different than the perception that they have even of each other in the beginning. So it's just an interesting take on that.
Mm-hmm. To give a little historical context about the Korean War, Japan had occupied Korea for 35 years, starting in 1910. Rather than returning the country to its own sovereignty, it was divided between the Soviets and the Americans in 1948. North Korea and South Korea became separate states, each determined to establish its place with a legitimate government of Korea. During the occupation, Japan forced hundreds of thousands of Korean women into a life as comfort women, which was essentially sexual slavery. And they served in military brothels. The war in Korea is often called the Forgotten War. The conflict lasted 3 years, from June of 1950 until July of 1953. And it was an incredibly bloody conflict, an estimated 3 million people killed. And just to give context, like the Second World War had ended 5 years before this. So the world has seen a lot of violence and death in the previous decade. And it was likely the deadliest conflict of the Cold War period. There were war crimes and atrocities on both sides. So both the North and South Korean factions committed war crimes. Mm. And the United States military, along with the other UN forces that were involved, were also accused of war crimes. Mm. It's also especially notable, as we mentioned earlier, because it was the first military theater in which the army was desegregated. In 1948, Harry Truman signed an executive order desegregating the military, and he thought this would help the nation overcome racial discrimination after many Black veterans of World War II had written to him and told him how badly they were treated upon returning to American soil, despite having served their country. Many commanders in the military continued to ignore this order. They just refused to desegregate their units. And some Black servicemen who did serve in the military in desegregated units still faced a lot of discrimination. So it was just sort of like I think it's very interesting that the story touches upon this war that is essentially the forgotten war. You almost never hear anyone talk about the war in Korea, despite the fact that we're still dealing with the consequences of it all this time later.
Yeah.
But it was very important because it happened right before the civil rights movement really like took off. And it was the first time that Black soldiers really were, you know, able to at least officially have places in integrated units. And yet we see that when Tick returns home, he's still treated badly, right?
Yeah. And he speaks to that. They like, even when Jay is like, hey, do you guys know Judy Garland? And they're like, yeah, no, I would be like her butler. And she didn't understand what they were saying. And then finally got, well, why would you fight in this situation? It's, you know, there's some context here that's really fascinating to me about, you know, all the themes that we've been talking about, even down to, you know, the fact that, like you said, we're still dealing with some of the fallout of some of this, based on the fact that this is on the heels of World War II, that this is on the heels of Japan being defeated and what we did there. And that has its own level of like, atrocity and like horrible. The way that what happened out of that is also tough with dropping a bomb. But this is also us dividing a nation, right? Like half of the nation went to Russia and half of the nation went to the United States. And then the people's ideologies didn't mix because our ideologies don't mix. And then now you have cousins fighting cousins, people fighting each other, a nation divided, which it's really wild to me to see like that fallout and that context in that sense, and then put it in the context of our story, where you see very similarly, this is about a family that's divided, right? You see the Braithwaites who have a bloodline who runs into Tick's bloodline, and then he is part of their family, and they're trying to figure out a way, each side of that family, to figure out how to one up the other one to make sure that they don't go out based on what's happening. So it's really interesting, the dynamic play by the historical context that they do in the story, mm-hmm. and the story building.
And I always find it interesting that the Cold War is called a Cold War, mm-hmm. right? But mm-hmm. many people died in the Cold War.
Yeah.
You know, there were two actual hot wars yeah. in the Cold War.
Yeah.
So,
Agreed. You
know, it's sort of a shame that we don't acknowledge this in our lengthy history in the 20th century of conflict between capitalism and communism, but it's definitely acknowledged here. And I think they picked a really interesting point in history to drop us in the story.
Yeah, and I was really blown away by my research on Japan's role in Korea, right? Like I had no concept that was happening there either, right? And man, it's hard for me not to think about in general, like these wars, and not go back. I know for all our listeners that are hearing us on the heels of doing all the ATLA coverage, I just think about some of the themes that are in that story still when discovering some of the themes of like how we as a country have taken certain actions in other countries and how other nations have acted toward it. Like it was hard for me not to think about the 100-year war, thinking about the Korean War and how that was in the fallout from what happens after the 100-year war in the comics, which hopefully we'll have a chance to talk to you guys about at some point. So it's really interesting to see the tie-ins in a lot of, you know, fantasy stories that really play into reality, that how we really have lived in our real world, how fantasy can teach us a lot about that too.
Yeah. So let's move on to episode 7. I Am. So this episode has two tracks. After both dreaming of Hannah at Titus's lodge, holding the actual Book of Names, which on first watch, I did not notice that's what she was holding.
No.
Tick and Letty go to find Montrose to find out more about Tick's mother's family. They find Sammy coming out of Montrose's apartment and see them holding hands, confirming that Montrose is gay. So this was awkward. Very awkward. And I feel like, you know, Tick has a lot of feelings about his dad. I did not like his reaction here.
No, he has a tough run in these last two episodes. Tick has a tough run. Like what we saw previous episode and then when we see this one and the language he uses even. And like his dad said, don't ever call me out of my name. I'm still your dad. Like, you know what I mean? Like it was rough.
Yeah, he was very disrespectful. It's such a fraught relationship, though, because we have to also remember what Montrose put Tick through.
Yes, 100%.
So their relationship is kind of, it's hard to judge, right? Because mm-hmm. Montrose put Tick through abuse.
Yeah.
And is an alcoholic. And, you know, Montrose is dealing with his own trauma, as we will learn in a later episode. Mm-hmm. So it's just their relationship is very very fraught.
The part that was most painful to me is when you get the context of his response when they go downstairs, and Letty doesn't even have words for it. She just tries to figure out how to get onto the next subject, is when he says he beat me, like whipping my ass because he wanted to get rid of the soft parts in me. And it just hit me different, because I think, like, I just want to take this moment, like, in the Black community, there's a lot of homophobia in a way that I don't particularly, you know, I've traversed and dealt with in my life, of seeing that, not as a person who's gay, but as a person who's been in the community. And it's really tough, because there's also undergirding that is this sense of machismo that we sometimes, of overcompensating our masculinity that we struggle with as Black males. And so to, like, this idea of you're soft, and being, what I did hit that is being a person who was really sensitive as a kid. And I used to get upset, and the first thing would happen would be waterworks. Not because I had a degree of empathy for things. And it used to bother me that I couldn't be, that I would, like, feel not empathetic, or, and I'm not allowed to be empathetic or sad, or I used to feel like I had to hold those things in. So this was like a real thing that I think Tick probably struggled with, being a bibliophile, being a Black geek, being all those things. He probably had that level of sensitivity that he had to harden based on that trauma that we're talking about. And that's super tough. And it was a place where I really connected to Tick as a character, not his mm-hmm. views on gay people, but I connected to that feeling of having to cover up who you are and your emotions because of what the society tells you you need to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly relatable. So Tick runs away because he's pissed. But Letty discovers that Tick's mother had a cousin who survived the Tulsa riots and is now living in St. Louis. So Tick goes to see this cousin. He will receive a call from Letty telling him that Hippolyta is in danger. But that comes a little bit later. And Ruby and Letty reconcile. And the two of them take care of Dee, who, you know, is a... by herself, since Hippolyta decides that she's going to go on her own adventures. During this episode, Letty also realizes that she is pregnant, which is a major complication. Mm-hmm. So Hippolyta's journey is really the focus of this episode. After the events of episode 4, Hippolyta and Dee went back to Ardham, where they find Dee's comic in the rubble, and she knows that George was there. So she knows the story about George being shot by a sheriff doesn't quite stack up. She heads back to Chicago and figures out how to activate the orrery, and it sends her to a location in Kansas where she finds a machine that can tear through time and space, and she activates it. The police arrive, and so does Tick. This is right after Tick receives a phone call from Letty saying Hippolyta is probably in danger, and a fight ensues. Hippolyta shoots and kills one of the officers, and she is pulled into an open portal. She appears to be in the future, or maybe in space. It's not really
clear. It's in the ether. Like, it's not really clear where she is, but it looks super cool. It's like, whoa, where is
she? Yeah, it's really cool. And we should talk a little bit about Afrofuturism later.
Yeah.
But she is really struggling, trying to get out of this place. And a figure appears and tells her, you are not in a prison. And ask her where she wants to be. She gets to name herself. Hippolyta settles on Paris, dancing with the great Josephine Baker.
Woo.
And her adventures really continue from there. She befriends Josephine Baker, who understands and relates to her. They're both putting on a show, after all, being exactly who society wants them to be. Her next destination takes her to a universe where other Black women warriors fight Confederate soldiers. It's clearly an entirely different universe. This is not time travel. This never happened.
Yeah.
And she also returns to a place where George is still alive, and she tells him how she felt, that she was shrinking into herself in order to fit in. Hippolyta is on her own journey of self-discovery, and she takes George with her to the next destination. Mm. Eventually, she meets with the same entity, the woman who asked her where she wanted to be, who she wanted to be, and what to name herself. And she's told that she can integrate into their society, or she can go home. She chooses to be Hippolyta, Dee's mother.
Yeah, I love that the tie-in to all this is that she keeps saying, I am Hippolyta. Like, that she keeps mentioning that to go to the next place is, like, really dope. Like,
yeah,
really
it's
dope.
It's showing the many facets of who she is and who mm-hmm. she could be if she had opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
We find out later that Tick, too, has gone through the portal. But when he comes out, Hippolyta is not there. And he's holding a book called Lovecraft Country. And so this episode was really about self-discovery and Black womanhood. And we talked a little bit last week about Ruby and her own self-discovery and her feeling like she was always being interrupted. This is the same feeling I think that Hippolyta is getting at when she's talking to George, that she bought into the idea that she could only be certain things. And over time, she kept making herself smaller and smaller mm-hmm. and smaller. And she tells Josephine Baker that she hates white folks. Mm-hmm. And then she also hates other people, but also she hates herself for letting them make her feel small. Mm-hmm. This was deeply moving to me. Like, this is, I think, a theme that a lot of Black women can relate to. A lot of women can relate to.
Yeah.
You're even seeing it now during the pandemic, where women are making sacrifices between who they could have been and what they were doing and trying to take care of other people, taking care of their families, taking care of their children. The burdens of being something to many people really falls on women differently.
Yeah.
And I found this quote that she said when she was preparing for battle, when her and the other Black women warriors were preparing to fight the Confederate soldiers. We are here because we did not believe them when they told us our rage was not ladylike. We did not believe them when they said our violence goes too far. We did not believe them when they said the hatred we feel for our enemies is not godlike. They say that to women like us because they know what will happen when we are free.
Mm.
That is, I think, again, many, many women can understand where she's coming from. There's been a lot of writing about the rage that women feel over the last few years and how it's not allowed. We're not allowed to be angry. Society tells us, maybe we don't use the word ladylike anymore, but society tells us that female rage is not acceptable. The rage of men is understandable, but our frustration with how society boxes us in, makes us feel small, limits our opportunities, is never really allowed to breathe. And I thought they did a really amazing job in this episode of just showing how that Hippolyta could be so many more things than George's wife and Dee's mother, even though those were things that she chose to do as well.
Yeah.
She goes back to a moment when George is still alive so she can tell him that this is how she felt. And I thought that was really powerful. She still, of all the adventures she could choose, she still wanted to be George's wife and she still wants to be Dee's mom. So I just really loved this whole episode and its exploration of both self-discovery for all of us, right? Like, what, this is why we like fantasy, because it allows us to go on adventures.
Yeah.
It allows us to put ourselves in different situations and imagine how we may behave. And also tying that in with the very specific experiences that Black women have in trying to fit into smaller and smaller boxes, the box that society puts you in, the box that your family puts you in, the box that you put yourself in. So I thought this was a really beautiful episode. And when I first watched it, I didn't realize it was going to be so impactful on the series plot. I thought this was just sort of like an episode that was about self-discovery. But nope. It actually has big consequences for the plot.
It sets up the whole multiverse, right? It sets up the idea of the multiverse and what that means in this world that we're in, which is, and everything you're saying. I really thought it was powerful, the imagery that they chose as well, the people that they chose. And like you said, her still choosing to be, you know, George's wife and Dee's mom, but having all these facets of her. I mean, let's talk about Hippolyta. Even before she goes through the portal, she is a person who named a star, right? She named a star and didn't get credit for it. She's also a person who, if you look, has done a, even though George has gone out, he can acknowledge that, like, she's, you know, if more talented possibly than him in some of the actual figuring out of things. Look at what she figured out, even about, like, you know, the Ori that nobody else could figure out. Like, she did the work and figured it out and came to the conclusion of how to open the portal to the multiverse and how to do all that. And even when she's in that room, when she's by herself, she's taking apart scientifically, okay, am I on another planet? Okay, this person looks like this. Where is this? This is happening here. This happened here, so it can't be another planet. She's like doing this from scientific, like just off the top of her head. So she's a phenomenal person. And you know, the fact that this brilliant mind and this brilliant person has been made to feel small in society is a travesty. And it's something that mm-hmm. makes you feel excited to see her like expanding in this episode. I think Josephine Baker was a really, really good choice, because here's a woman who was beautiful by any stretch of the imagination and was definitely not treated so in America, and was only treated so on behalf of what she looked like in France, right? It wasn't like she had there was a lot of struggle there, because they didn't see the fullness of who she was. They, you know, in France, she was accepted because of like her sexuality. And in America, she wasn't accepted at all because she was a Black woman who had numerous gifts. She was an amazingly talented artist in person and activist. And so I think like that was a good person to choose. And what she says in that interaction where she says, you know, sometimes I feel like a star, not a Hollywood star. Anybody can be that. But like one of those stars that's in the Black sky of space, like, you know, that burns up. And she's like talking about how exhausting, in my opinion, what I took from that is how exhausting it is to know the fullness of who you are and to be not recognized. And in that moment, you see Hippolyta go to the next place, which I felt like Nuri was an approximation of another African story that I want to talk about more in another later on down the road in our coverage of this. But Nzinga, like Nzinga is a warrior that doesn't get told enough in our lore here. But here's a person who created, for all intents and purposes, was a queen in Angola who created a whole martial art to shield the ability for people that still exist today, capoeira, for people to like as a dance. So it was an art form, it was a martial art, and it was something that she had a hand in creating. So it's really interesting that they chose those people and places in history, and then to see Afrofuturism on such full display, I thought was great. And I think as a episode, watching this episode about the, you know, self-discovery for women, I thought one of the parts that really hit me as a man watching this was George's piece, where he actually has that moment of recognition of, he tries to deny that he was like playing a part in her making herself smaller, and then he has to recognize, oh no, I did do that because I wanted to feel comfortable with where you were placed in my life. And that's something that I think each of us as men can like look at and do an audit of every time we possibly can, to see, okay, am I playing into this kind of idea that keeps the person who I'm in an intimate relationship with, or my daughters, or my mom, in a certain place or space in my mind that's comfortable for me, versus encouraging the women in our life to be all that they're as big as they possibly can be. And him coming to that realization was really strong for me as well in this episode.
Yeah, I don't think it's a mistake that wherever Hippolyta goes, she's essentially surrounded by other women, mm-hmm. that other women help her discover herself. I don't think that that's, I think that that is a thing that women can speak to, and that having other women as your friends is so important, and supporting each other. And so I think that, you know, men do play a role in this, and society certainly at large does. And I thought it was beautiful that George acknowledged what his role was. And, you know, these two genuinely love each other. Mm-hmm. It was sad to see them together again in a way, because we know that it's probably temporary. So I thought this was a great episode. I really loved it.
All right. So let's talk about episode 8, Jigabobo. The episode begins with an event that was foreshadowed in episode 3. And, you know, we also see it foreshadowed in the previous episode when he's missing from game night, when they're playing, you know, spades. You know, Tick, Letty, Montrose, and Ruby accompany Dee to the funeral of her best friend, Bobo, who we know to be Emmett Till. While the adults discuss what's best for her, Dee slips away. She finds herself confronted by two police officers who found her comic at the site of where her mother has disappeared. One of the officers spits on her and curses her, asking her if she believes in magic. As the result of this curse, Dee is followed all day by two apparitions that she can only see, Topsy and Bopsy. They're scary AF.
They're terrible. These two are awful.
Oh my God. Listen, I don't need children Harlem shaking and scary ass makeup. The shit was wildly scary.
This was the
oh my
stuff
God.
Of nightmares. Like these, it was terrifying.
I don't know what it is. Like I literally was like, they topped the freaking kids in The Shining for me. These kids were way scarier. They were dancing and they looked like they were having fun tormenting her. And then you think, well, these kids are scary enough. But the scene that we're going to talk about later on when she's running through the neighborhood, they even did an homage to the fucking Freddy Krueger girls with the like jump rope, the, you know, one, two, Freddy's. I was like, I'm done. Scary children. No, let's stop. Anyway, let's move on. The horrific beings torment Dee throughout the whole entire day while Montrose, Letty, and the whole crew fail to see her suffering, which is like painful. Dee eventually fights back. She confronts the officers about the curse, which bars from my girl. My mama's name is Hippolyta. It's Greek, asshole. Like, it ain't, you know what I mean? Like, that shit was, yes, I love
it. Also, it stinks in here.
Oh, it's fucking great. Oh, so she waits for the dancing ghouls ready to fight back in her parents', you know, garage. And Montrose comes in and tries to protect her, but unable to see Topsy and Bopsy. He is unable to, and they start hurting her. And she's saying, like, you know, get off of me. Let me go. And they're now killing her, basically, like just like going after her. Also, Ruby doesn't look for Dee very long. Instead, she heads over to Christina's house for a little afternoon delight. Skyrockets in flight. I don't know what's going on with her and in her mind. And they have what we would like to dub as strange sex.
Very strange sex. So wild. It was, I'm like, what is even happening here? That was one of the weirdest sex scenes I've ever seen. Like, I just couldn't, I was like, I don't understand what I'm supposed to get from this.
This show has a lot of blood when it comes to sex. There's so much blood in like the Camijo episode and in this episode. It's just like, she's shedding her skin and there's like different people and then like they're bleeding on each other. I'm like, this is wild, you know?
Yeah, it was a lot to take in.
Anyway, after, you know, they get down and get cleaned up, Christina's chilling. She's taking a little phone call. And what I have to say was an impeccably shot scene. The design, the costume design and the set design on that shot alone was amazing. With the old school phone on the couch, with the outfit Christina's wearing, it was absolute. I was like, that should be a still photograph. It was dope. And there's a lot of that that happens in the show. Basically, she confronts Christina about her white privilege and the lack of caring about the brutal death of Emmett Till. And later in the episode, Christina will hire two men to do to her what happened to Emmett Till. But of course, she survives because she's got magic and she wanted to just feel what was going on there. And also, I think she wanted to prove her invulnerability that she was actually able to do that.
Yeah, I think ultimately she wanted to prove her invulnerability, but she could have done that by asking someone to shoot her in the head.
Yeah.
I think here she is actually trying to understand the suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure what the show is trying to say about that. But anyway.
Yeah, and I think what was interesting is that conversation is pivotal, right? Because she's also calling out Ruby on her shit. She's like, yeah, I think that you are like saying all this stuff to me, but ultimately, you know, you're a woman that wanted what she wanted in that moment. And you are trying to grapple with the fact that that's what you wanted. You wanted to be comforted in that moment. And you're trying to now make me feel bad about it. She pushes it back on Ruby and calls on her shit. And I think that ultimately, though, that Ruby got a punch in that conversation because it made her. I think you, me and you both will agree. We've talked about it offline and we'll say it here, that we really do believe Christina has feelings for Ruby and Ruby has feelings for her, that they actually care for each other. And I think that this made her think, like, I want to understand what this person I care about goes through. And in some ways that stung her a little bit, that she actually did not care, you know?
Yeah. I think so.
So anyway, Gia shows up at Letty's house, which, you know, automatically. Oh, man. It's so good. Oh, man. The awkwardness was great. And she tells Letty, as Tick shows up and sees the shoes outside, he's like, oh, wait, no, I've seen this before. Where? Oh, shit. And he walks in and she lets him know she's a Kamihu. And that she, in her vision, saw his death. And basically, that causes drama between Letty and Tick because she's pissed that Tick left a major detail of seeing that monsters existed before they got together out of the story. She's like, what the hell? And, you know, she also puts together, of course, that Gia actually loves Tick. And, you know, with what she knows is going on, that she doesn't know that Tick knows of being pregnant and everything else, she's got a lot of feelings going on, a lot of things going on in her mind about what's happening here, from what I'm picking up. And desperate to change the course of the future, Tick goes to Christina, giving her the key to the Ori that he had and to get help with spells because he's trying to protect himself and his family. It turns out that the book Atticus brought back from the portal was by his son, and that in the book, Christina sacrifices him on the autumnal equinox. And he finds this out after being put right before he's pushed back through the portal by a woman with a robotic arm. After this heart to heart that Montrose and Atticus have, they try to cast a spell. He lets him know the new things about himself. And this is interesting because there's a moment that will play out later. But he says to him, he says, hey, I'm dyslexic. And he goes, any more secrets you keep me from me? And Montrose just wants to get to the magic because, yeah, there's a few things he should probably let him know. But he's not yet. And they cast a spell, but nothing happens. So they think that nothing is going to happen. After the scene in which D calls out the cops for their funky ass hygiene,
well, also they have a body in there, right? Isn't this the same office where Ruby saw the decomposing guy in the closet?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, they got some stinky shit happening inside this office. So after that, Letty is also attempting to get protection. She goes to the only place she knows to seek it, which is the church, and she actually is revealed as the person who called Christina while Christina and Ruby were having their conversation. Christina shows up to meet her there and won't provide invulnerability for Tick, but instead gives it to Letty. The episode ends with the police attacking Letty's house. The cops who were in the office when Dee was in there say they're going to get what's theirs, and they decide to concoct a plan to go into the house and get the Ori. When they show up, they're unable to enter the house because of the protection spell that Letty has put on the house. So at that point, The cops open fire on the house. Cops just start shooting at the house and everyone's ducking down. And this is where we see that the invulnerability spell actually did work for Letty, as the bullets, a great scene, bullets are flying around her. But then Tick hears those gunshots, comes around the corner, and, you know, they look like they're about to shoot him. And Letty runs out to try to save him. But as they ring off the bullets and it starts going towards Tick, we find out that the spell actually did work, as a black Shoggoth comes out from the ground to protect him and wrecks these officers, like wrecks everything in its wake. He kills the officers. He's throwing cars around. And the episode ends with, you know, as they dodge all that and see everything, he kills he like maims the cops who are in the office. And the episode ends with Tick putting his hand on the head of the Shoggoth and realizing that the spell worked.
Okay. So this episode really focuses on the suffering of black children and how that often is done in a very lonely way. Mm. Dee is fleeing a horror that only she can see, right? And at the same time, these white children outside of Letty's house are having a regular day.
Yeah.
Having a regular day, jumping rope, having fun in the suburbs.
Regular, but still scary. Fucking scary.
I mean, creepy to us, but yes. Like, they're not experiencing the suffering that Dee is. I mean, she just lost her best friend in the worst way possible. A violent, violent killing, mm-hmm. Of a black young man who, for all we know, has done nothing wrong. And the adults are so wrapped up in their own drama that they can't even see how bad things are for her. Mm. You know, earlier in the episode when they're waiting to get inside of Emmett Till's funeral, Montrose says that experiencing death is a rite of passage for young black people in this country. And that's the attitude that the adults seem to take. And they sort of assume that she will be okay while they deal with their own stuff. Multiple times she tries to get assistance and no adults will really help her or see that she's struggling. Mm-hmm. This really made me think of a passage from Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. I'm just going to read some of that. Between the World and Me, for those of you who haven't read it, is a letter that Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote to his son. Hmm. And the entire book is written in from his point of view talking to his son. Hmm. And he talks about the state of race in America and, you know, how that makes him feel. So this is from the book. "That was the week that you learned the killers of Michael Brown would go free. The men who had left his body in the street like some awesome declaration of their inviolable power would never be punished. It was not my expectation that anyone would be punished, but you were young and still believed. You went to your room and I heard you crying. I came in minutes after and I didn't hug you. I didn't comfort you because I thought it would be wrong to comfort you. I did not tell you that it would be okay because I never believed it would be okay. What I told you is what your grandparents told me, that this is your country, that this is your world, that this is your body, and you must find some way to live with all of it." Mm. That is essentially what black children experience in life around the vulnerability that they are born with, that this is never going to be okay, that you're not going to be okay, that you have to learn to live through violence, that you have to learn to live understanding that this is a country that doesn't value you the same it does your white peers. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was really highlighted well in this story. I mean, she's literally being chased by something that's invisible, but is terrifying.
Yeah,
and I just wanted to pull out that passage because I think it's a powerful reminder that what she's experiencing is true for a lot of black children in the country.
And it's a great, it's you're so on point with it, because I, the scene that really I knew the tone of this was coming was when, actually early in the episode, when she sees two, you know, black girls who are unaffected by what's going on, and they're eating ice cream and they're like enjoying their day and just laughing. And you see in that moment when she yells at them and says, and throws rocks and says, nothing's, there's nothing to laugh about, nothing's funny. That, that thing that happens a lot where we talk about the talk or having the conversation, like what, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates is talking about when his son still had hope, is that loss of innocence. That loss of innocence, that idea where there's a moment in which you realize that, 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 you know, there's like, you stop being a kid. And there's a crossover to that, that is rough to the way that they, I guess the way that they showed it with this idea of this, the, these, this imagery from the past and it being a haunting image, and how black kids kind of like traverse these different horrors and kind of feel isolated was super powerful. And I love that you brought that, that, that passage up, because I agree.
Yeah. I mean, just to be clear, Ta-Nehisi is not saying here that this was the right way to behave to his son, right? Yeah. But he's being honest about in that moment how he wanted his son to understand this, that it's not going to be okay. This is not something that I can kiss your forehead and wish away. And I just, I think it's really a shame that parents are put in this position that they have to even have these talks, that they have to even wonder about this. I mean, so many parents have really just struggled even this year and how to explain, you know, the murder of George Floyd, the fact that they, that black parents had to go then tell their children that the Black Panther died. It's just very sad. So I thought this episode did a really good job of demonstrating the how isolating Black children often feel, and like Black parents and adults are dealing with their own stuff. Like, it's a lot. This is a unique experience to Black Americans, which is dealing with all the stuff that is going on in the country all the time. And then on a, in addition to that, dealing with racism, and these folks also have magic that they have to deal with. So it's just, it's a lot. They're not able to give her what she needs in this moment or protect her. And even if they, when Montrose tries to protect her, he can't, because he doesn't see the same terror that she sees. He's dealing with his own terror.
Yeah. And then the part of when she's confronted by the cops and they're trying to put the spell on her, and one person has her in a chokehold and she's like legitimately saying, I can't breathe. And how many times have we heard that? Like, she's saying that over and over again. And so that, that tie into our common, our modern day things, you know, for me, I've lived this experience like that, that Ta-Nehisi writes about, in the sense that, you know, my dad had had that conversation with me around when Yusuf Hawkins was killed, and basically saying, hey, you know what, like, that's why I'm so hard on you. I want you to make it to live past 25. Like, that was my dad's legitimate goal. Like, man, I'm trying to get you past, I heard that so much as a kid, I want you to live beyond like other kids in the neighborhood and get beyond 25. And I was like, wow. So I know that experience of like having that isolation of like, oh, I gotta move differently. And that's a weird thing, right? When you see other people not moving that differently in the world. So I definitely think that that's a real thing. So let's go into Topsy and Bopsy a little bit. In Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, she describes Topsy as an 8 or 9 year old, and besides being very black, had round shiny eyes glittering as glass beads and woolly hair braided into little tails, which stuck out in every direction. This caricature reflects the way that racist white people see black children, unkempt and simple, and thus less valued than white children. Dee is being chased through the streets by pickaninnies who represent how the hostile world is to black children, right? So this is kind of like hitting on what we've been talking about. That book has a lot of that within it. And as you see, the cover art kind of turns into the characters there. But it's the chase of that imagery of how you see that context too, that contrast of like how Dee is represented
versus this imagery of the past that is actually still haunting a lot of the perception of how we should interact with our children and with how the world interacts with Black children.
So let's discuss episode 9, Rewind 1921. This episode takes us back to the Tulsa riots of 1921. And from the dialogue of the show, we know that George, Montrose, and Tick's mother, Dora, all survived these riots. But Dora was the only person in her family to survive. Hippolyta's return gives the gang the opportunity to find the Book of Names, which they need to save Dee, who is unconscious. Using the time machine that Hippolyta used and also the little inserts that she now has in her wrist, Montrose, Tick, and Letty head back to the day of the riots. The moment it takes them back to them shows them the brutality that Montrose suffered under his father. Young Montrose, after being beaten by his father and embarrassed, runs off to find Thomas, a young man who he had feelings for, to say that he isn't gay and, you know, he wants to end things. In that moment, they're beset by white rioters. Thomas is murdered, but George and Dora arrive just after to protect Montrose until they're all outnumbered. Now, Montrose, adult Montrose, is telling Tick, who's nearby, that a stranger came with a bat like Jackie Robinson that saved them that day. They have to be very careful here not to change the past, right? Because they want to still, you know, Ticks exists because this moment happened.
Yeah, and they're waiting for this stranger to show up. It's wild. Great scene.
So they're just standing there and waiting for the stranger. He's, you know, Montrose is sort of like, it's going to be fine. The stranger comes. And then they realize that Tick was that stranger. Tick intervenes and saves them, and boy, does he beat the hell out of everybody.
Yeah, he does.
He really does. Letty, meanwhile, has gone to retrieve the book from Dora's house, where she is chased into by white rioters and is taken in by Dora's family. Dora's grandmother, Hattie, realizes that something is amiss with Letty. She looks at her shoes, not having it. She's like, you are not from around here. And Letty is forced to tell Hattie the truth. And Hattie, when she learns that this is the woman from the future that is carrying future generations, she gives her the Book of Names, which she
How wild is it, though, that, like, she walks in the room like, your shoes are off. You know what? You best start telling the truth, or there's going to be a bullet between your eyes. And the first leadoff is, okay, I'm from the future. And she, like, buys it. She's like, okay, yeah, all right, cool.
She totally buys it. And this was a little bit of a reach for me, because Hattie tells her that the book was passed down to her, but she was told never to open it. She was told never to use it. So it's clear that Hattie doesn't know much about magic, but she just kind of buys this I'm from the future story.
It was like, no, that's not going to get you shot. Like, she's like, listen, I'm from the future. I'm dating, like, your great grandson. You know, like, I have a baby. I'm like, whoa, this is if I was Hattie, I would have been like, whoa, this is crazy. All right, go ahead. I'm sorry. I just had to throw that in.
Yeah. So let's suspend our disbelief. But. She hands over the book to her, and you know, Hattie realizes in this moment that she's going to die, and so is most of her family. I think the only reason that Dora survived is because she was off with George trying to save Montrose. The two of them save the Lord's Prayer together as Hattie burns to death. Tick and Montrose make it back through the portal just as Hippolyta is losing control of it. She can't hold it very long. And Letty slowly walks through the burning city of Tulsa to head back with the book and makes it through the portal as well.
Yeah, I want to take a moment. We're not going to go into it because we're going to cover this later down the road. But the poem, Where Is Your Fire, is playing over this. And the thing that's really powerful to me is that as Letty's walking through and all these questions are being posed to both the characters, but I've took it as opposed to us, is like, after seeing so much of this kind of tragedy of people putting a town of of black people to the torch of the brutality. Where is the fire? Like, let's like within us to transcend, to make the steps necessary to build community, to build, to overcome this, not just get lulled to sleep by what's happened. But I really just want to shout out the creators for taking that poem and writing an opera, in which we will talk about more. But I'm blown away that they did that. And it's actually, I thought it was already a piece that existed, but the fact that they said, no, we're going to write an opera for this moment and give it its proper treatment was mind blowing to me. Anyway.
So let's talk a little bit about what they're trying to show here. So this is the second show that HBO has had on in the last year or so that talked about the Tulsa riots. It referred to them. So we'll talk about the history of it, but I just want to acknowledge that the show is trying to show us the impacts of intergenerational trauma and the sacrifices that were lost to racial violence. So it's clear that Dora's family had accumulated some wealth. Mm-hmm. Like most of the black families that were targeted in these riots, mm-hmm. in Tulsa, everything was lost, including the book would have been lost if Letty had not time traveled to get it. So the violence that people experience in their lives is not just about what happens to them. It also impacts future generations. And that becomes even more clear in the next episode.
100%.
But also, it would be wrong of us to not take a moment to acknowledge Montrose's trauma. So each of these characters has sort of had an episode where we learned more about them. Mm. Here we are learning how horrible Montrose's experiences were on this particular day. This was the worst day of his life. Mm. He gets his, you know, crush, a young man that he had connected to. He essentially feels guilty for getting him killed. If he'd never called him to the square that night to essentially break it off with him, he would have maybe survived. Mm. His own father is violent and hostile against him. He is humiliated publicly by his father. And then in addition, there's the white violence that traumatizes him. He was afraid for his life in this moment. So I just think that we have to look at how that impacted this day, this moment impacted Montrose and possibly contributed to him becoming an alcoholic, him becoming an abuser himself, him being violent. This is a representation of the type of trauma that we pass to our children that stays in our bloodline. It can only be interrupted, you know, when we deal with the trauma.
And I'm getting like chill. I agree with you so much. And I think like the part that really like hit me, man, was the scene before Tick runs out and, you know, starts battling and saving them, and then says the line, you know, "I got you, kid," which is like, you know, a throwback all the way to episode one and all throughout the story, is that Montrose is explaining to him, they leave it ambiguous to a point, but I think in this conversation I got out of it that he's saying to him that Thomas is just a long list of sacrifices that I made to be your father, which when you see the way Dora protects him and the way George has advocated for him to the best of his ability, it just appears to me that Dora and George were actually in love, and that Montrose, and that she also loved Montrose, and that this marriage was a marriage of convenience, that they got married so that he would never have to deal with the brutality because of his sexuality, because of all the trauma that he suffered. And they were all in it together. They were like, listen, that's what I took out of the conversation, that he felt like saving Thomas would not change Tick existing, because he felt strongly in that moment that while I'm like your father, I'm not your biological father. And that's why he was willing to take the chance to save him. That was my take away. It may not be where the story's going, but that's my take on it.
So let's talk a little bit about what happened in Tulsa.
Yeah.
Because I think that both this show and Watchmen kind of just threw us in there, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. They don't really explain how we got to this point. So the Tulsa race riots, which were essentially a massacre, took place on May 31st and June 1st of 1921. It's one of the worst episodes of race-based violence in this country's modern history. Mobs of white residents, many of them had been deputized and given weapons by city officials, attacked the black residents and businesses of the Greenwood District in Tulsa, where a lot of black people had built up wealth and, you know, were landowners. Like the brutal lynching of Emmett Till, the massacre started because of an accusation that a young black man was accused. He was accused of assaulting a young white woman. After a confrontation between black and white men at the jail, the black men were there to protect the young man. The white men were there to, we have to assume, lynch him. The violence escalated and white rioters started to set fire to black-owned businesses and homes. In the early morning hours, witnesses said explosives were dropped from private aircrafts. Let's just take a second to acknowledge that explosives, bombs, were dropped from private aircrafts over the Greenwood District. Nearly 200 people were killed. 2,000 businesses were destroyed. 2,000 homes were destroyed in the fire, and 215 businesses were looted. The trauma that the black community in Tulsa, you know, experienced is still felt today. Like this week, a mass grave that is suspected to contain the remains of victims was unearthed by the city. Oof. And I just also want to acknowledge that around this period, Oklahoma has a very fraught racial history. Around this same period, not so far away in Osage County, there were murders of Osage Native Americans, Osage Indigenous people, to take their land because the Osage were very wealthy. So this whole part of the country, really, but especially in Oklahoma, like, killing people to take their land, killing people who had accumulated wealth, was, I have to say, common practice.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know this, but like the Osage murders were one of the reasons that the FBI was established, because they could not trust the local officials to stop the killing, to bring to justice the people who were killing the Osage to take their land. So there's a lot of racial violence wrapped up in this moment in history. And I just want to acknowledge that it was happening at the same time. So clearly this was part of the culture.
Yeah. Yeah. And because while Watchmen like brought up the general portion of it, you know, some of the things that stood out for me in this episode were seeing the black people in the fighting back, you know, like like seeing them like, no, we got shotguns, we're fighting back. And that doesn't happen a lot in depictions. And I think the other thing was the moment when Letty is walking and the bombs are going off and the flames are all around her, and when Montrose is looking on and he's naming names of people that had shops and that what happened, like, from memory. And I don't know, I didn't get a chance to do research to see whether or not those names of those people were real people that lived in that town. But what I think sometimes when you have these mass terrible events, it takes it from the theoretical or the, you know, the big version of it to like the human aspect of it. Like, they were real people, like that had families and had stores that this happened to. And so that was really powerful. And I thought a masterstroke by the showrunners to do that, you know? So.
I totally agree. Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes us right to this moment and shows us the impact. This episode was a lot, but it was very well done.
100%. And then it takes us full circle, right? Just like the episode, you know, is called, to episode 10, right? So episode 10, the finale for this season. Hopefully, man, we'll talk about this more, but hopefully we get more than just this season. But we'll say the, for this season and the show right now, episode 10 is the finale. And the episode opens with the main characters trying to revive Dee. Atticus and Letty pass out as soon as Tick does an incantation from the book. Tick has traveled back to Titus's lodge, where Hannah has summoned him, and Letty has returned to the house in Tulsa to speak with Hattie. Both of them learn what happened to Hannah after escaping the lodge. Her trauma haunted her until she killed herself, but before she did, she put a spell on her bloodline so that the future generations would stay hidden. Hattie and Hannah tell the young couple that it is up to them to fix the mistakes of her past. Atticus gets to reunite with his mother briefly, but first they heal Dee. She wakes and is partially healed, though her arm is badly wounded, and it's going to be that way. It looks permanent, that the damage that has happened. After deciding to use Christina's spell against her, Tick and Letty head back to the museum and summon the man himself, Titus Braithwaite. With the help of Hannah, Hattie, and Dora, Tick takes a piece of flesh from Titus, and Letty suggests that they use Ruby to get the piece of Christina. And just then, Christina arrives asking for the book of names. Because, you know, Titus popped up. He did a little pop. He's like, oh, wait, hold on. Y'all trying to gang up on
he
me?
He did a little, hey, my only white descendant, yeah. Help. And then he's summoned back.
they got him wrapped around. They're doing it. So, what happens is that Christina does show up and she tries to cut a deal. Hey, you know what? Maybe there's another way in the book of names for me to not have to murk you, dude. Just give me the book of names and I won't mess with you or your family or anybody. And that'll be that. And Tick says, no, I'm not going to do that. And so, pissed off, Christina walks out. And you know what I'm going to take with me? I'm going to take that invincibility, Letty. Go on and give me that back. I need that back. She takes the invincibility away from Letty, from the protection spell. And that at that point, Letty wants to go ahead and meet up with her sister Ruby, and they do, and they meet up at their mother's grave, and Letty's request that, you know, she change her mind and help them. She wants her to help them, like, to get Christina's blood or a piece of Christina so that they can basically reverse Christina's spell so that Tick doesn't have to die. Tick also goes and apologizes to Gia. Letty convinces Tick to be baptized because Tick is not really a believer in that way, but he does it for her. And she asks in a very touching scene for him to believe in them, that they're gonna be okay, his son and her. And then the entire gang, along with Gia and Ruby, who does show up with a piece of Christina, head to Artem, thinking that they will use Christina's spell against her, singing one of our old-time favorites from episode one, Shaboom. They are, you know, life feels like a dream. They're singing. They're having a good time. Everyone's singing along. Dee sets off the sing-along. I love that because still had a little bit of joy in her. She's singing the sing-along. But Christina finds out that Ruby knew and has been impersonating her the whole time, and ambushes them with a mob of locals. She tells Letty that she's killed Ruby and pushes Letty out of the tower, and in her own skin, at that point, goes to sacrifice Tick. How did she get so clean so quick?
I know. This is a real problem. Not only is she clean, she's literally wearing a white dress. Like...
Yeah.
What?
This is like, wow, the whole place is burned down. I mean, maybe magic, you know, maybe magic. Maybe she just had a incantation that cleans off the blood. I don't know. Like, I also wondered, how does she stay as Ruby so long? Because it seemed like the time period was a lot less in staying in someone else's skin. And she seemed to have been able to stay as her for a long time.
I think you just have to keep dosing with the potion.
Oh, so she was taking a little blood shot.
But yeah, there's a lot of problems with this episode in terms of like transitions and what is believable. But
yeah, so even though she shows up, you know, she says, hey, nice little idea to reverse my spell on me. The you messed up, though, because you shouldn't have involved Ruby, which took to Montrose's credit. He said.
Yeah. Montrose was really like, nah.
He was like,
can't trust her.
No, he's like, fuck that. It's not going to work. This is bad. This is he's called out a lot of their bad plans. But all of a sudden we see that Tick is on the altar and she just starts, she cuts open his arms and starts bathing in his blood. She did say she needed all of his blood. I was like, God. So she's like bathing in the blood for this spell. She's saying, speaking in the tongue of Adam or language of Adam. And then we see Letty has woken up from her fall. She makes it there just as Tick is about to die. Letty and Tick say their goodbyes. She mouths the words, I love you, as everyone looks on, just mortified at the fact that he's being sacrificed. And Letty then runs up as Christina thinks she's, you know, as she's completed her spell, and stabs Christina in the back and through her. Like, pretty, you could see the blade on the other side of Christina, but the spell worked. So she turns around and laughs. She's not going to die. She is now, you know, immortal. Like, she doesn't, she's not going to die. And so Gia recalls what the shaman said in that moment about her becoming one with the darkness and realizes she must use her tails to connect Christina and Tick, and that that's how the spell will work. So she sees, she goes, runs up on the stairs, goes into a dark cloud that is going up to the moon, and at that moment, her tails shoot out and she connects both Tick and Christina, and Letty continues to say the words in the language of Adam to cast the spell, and it works. She sees both of their memories as they die, and she sees what Christina saw with Ruby. We see Ruby in a coma. We see Tick giving a letter to Hippolyta, and we see Tick also teaching the Shoggoth to to be loyal to Dee, which is really cool to see that. And then, you know, at that point, there's an explosion, and they take they basically, at that point, you see Letty walk up and tell Christina that she sealed off magic from her, that magic has been taken from her, but not only her, all white people from this world. Christina's crushed by the debris and calls out for them to help her. They leave with Tick's body. Montrose comes alive, wakes up and sees that Tick is dead and can't really handle it, and to Hippolyta gives him the letter, and we hear a voiceover to where he's tasking Montrose with helping with his son to get this is his second chance to be the dad he always wanted and not to mess it up, right? And at that point we see them walk off. Dee shows up and she survived the attack that she had earlier, and she has her Shoggoth with her, who shows up and puts Christina out of her misery, and he has a new robotic arm. Interesting robotic arm. We'll talk more about that. It's interesting, this robotic arm that shows up, because, you know, we heard about a robotic arm in another place in this story, which her mother has created for her based on her futuristic knowledge, which makes her a dope-ass mechanist, like our boy. Shout out to the mechanist in Atla. And also she happens to have drawing skills. She's nice with the pen. She learned all that art stuff. It's really dope. She's both she's a steam person. Sorry, Sokka. You got to go in another multiverse. So yeah, that's where we end. That's where it ends. D killing Christina and magic being taken away from white people on the earth and reclaimed by their family. Closing thoughts on the show. What did you think?
I loved so much of what they were trying to do with this show. So these are my favorite episodes in the second half of the series. I did really love the pilot. The first episode is wonderful. I just think that they were trying to do too much at times, and it becomes really overwhelming. And I think that is, like, if I were a casual viewer, if I hadn't watched many of these episodes multiple times, there were times where it just seemed chaotic. So I like all the the themes, and I really love the running themes throughout, which are like the connections of generations of family, you know, like just make like the monsters were significantly less scary than the things that we actually deal with in real life. So it's like that part I thought was really well done. But I also think that there were definitely points where certain threads of the story kind of got lost because there was so much happening. So I'm, I hope that this show comes back for a second season, especially because my girl Ruby, who I know can be problematic, but man, she deserved an on-screen death. So she better be back.
Yeah. I know a lot of people were mad.
I need to
at
see
that.
Ruby back.
Yeah, a lot of people were mad at Ruby dying off screen. It felt like so convenient and let us like have you and me have conversations that maybe she's not dead. And you know, I don't think she is.
I think Ruby is gonna be, it's very possible that Ruby will be the antagonist next season. We know that white people don't have access to magic anymore, at least Letty believes that. Now we also have seen Christina teach Ruby about magic, and we know that Ruby is eager to have access to magic, perhaps as Christina was.
Yeah.
And I just don't believe from what we've seen on screen between these two that Christina would have killed her.
Yeah.
I don't think that Christina thought thought Ruby was as disposable as Christina seems to treat other people. We saw that Christina did regularly actually stop herself from hurting people. She only really treated like people that she couldn't avoid killing is disposable. And I just don't buy that she believed that of Ruby. I think that she actually did have feelings for Ruby, whether they were romantic or friendship, I don't know, but I don't buy
it. I think there's a world where Christina walks into that place in her mind where she asked for the book of names, and they just say, oh, great, let's give you the book of names. In her mind, I think there's a world where she leaves out of there without harming any of them. I think there's actually a place where she comes in and says, oh, give me the book of names, in her mind, and they give her the book of names, and then Tick is alive and everybody goes on. I think that they decided that, no, that's not going to be how this story plays out. We've already decided how we're going to handle this. But I don't think that she...
Yeah, they can't trust her. I mean, I wouldn't have trusted her either. I wouldn't have given her the book
Me neither. No way. Not at all.
Yeah, but I agree with you, because she did seem genuine when she said that if the spell doesn't work, it means she would have killed the last members of her family for nothing.
Yep.
She did seem genuinely upset by that. So I just don't, I don't know that I buy that she killed Ruby. But, you know, we'll see. I do really hope there's a season two. I would love to see where the story, there was a point where I was like, there's no way there's going to be a season two. And I'm now of the mind of, I need answers to certain things. And I'd love to confirm that the mechanical arm woman is deep.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Because like, you know, she has this robotic arm. We talked about Afrofuturism. George Freeman, Tick and Letty's son, goes on to be a sci-fi writer. And we think that Diana is probably the woman who gave him the book and pushed him back through. Says he came in through a time where there were, you know, white people in the street rioting, he's talking about. Which, I mean, let's call it modern day our time. Like, we're all, like, there's a multicultural coalition in the streets, like, kind of, like, rioting and protesting. And, like, it's not, like, one. So that could have confused him a little bit coming from where he is, coming to our modern day. And then she pushes him through with the book in her arm. So it's possible that it's Dee, right? Because Dee is the only person that we know that has a robotic arm. And the future doesn't necessarily mean super far off in the future. It could mean, you know, just future from where he is. I also think everyone is in play. Like, literally, I think based on George coming back, which is a major miss of the ancestral realm, that George is not, like, sitting there doing the incantation with them in the museum. We talked about that offline. But I do think that a lot of, I just think that like everyone's in play based on seeing George and Hippolyta's like mission, that because of the multiverse aspects of it, There's Earth 504. There's the Earth that we're in right now. There's other versions of this story. So there's ways that people can come back based on the multiverse aspects that make me believe that there's some, that everyone's still in play.
Yeah, I think so. Listen, they haven't confirmed season two yet, but I'm really hoping that they get it because I would love to see all of these. I'd love to see George back, as you said. I want to see what happens with Dee. You know, Dee and George II, Tick and Letty's son, are the future.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Atticus's sacrifice was for them. You know, it was for the future. Just as Hannah stealing that book and then using the book and coming up with the spell was also for the future. One of the main themes of the show is sacrifice of previous generations for the future generation. So I want to see where they take that. I also think it was interesting that they introduced the notion that, you know, there could be magic on Letty's side too. This is me taking a little bit of a leap, but I don't think we knew earlier in the season that Letty's mother's last name was Baptiste, mm-hmm. which I just am going to go ahead and assume that she's from Louisiana, where we know, you know, there's a deep cultural magic in New Orleans and in that area. So I'm kind of curious to see if that comes up. Like, was Letty always destined to be with Tick? Is like, there's so much about destiny here too, like Gia, Tick, Hippolyta, Montrose, they're all tied together in ways that become clear throughout the season that they brought them to this moment that George Tick's son is going to write about in the book Lovecraft Country. Yep. So I love to see all of that, and I want to see where they take it.
Yeah, there's a real tilt towards determinism in this series that no matter what choices you make, you're going to end up at the same result. Like the many comments, like, you know, since he stepped into Artem, he was always going to be coming back. And people try to do all these different things, but I agree with you. And I thought about your comment about that because about their family. When I was rewatching, and Christina says to Ruby, "This involves, you know, your something called the Book of Names, Atticus, and your family." We all just make the assumption that only part of her family she's talking about is Letty, but is it though? You know what I mean? Like, I don't know that she didn't say "and your sister." She said "and your family." Like, so that mm-hmm. is that's a real big, I think, open-ended thing that I've been interested in seeing them develop. I hope they get a season two. And I think some of the pacing, my overall thoughts that felt like rushed or things that they just had to tie up. And ultimately, I think they landed at something that they could leave at one season and you'd be okay with it. But I think some of the reasons why it felt like that is more meta. It's like, you know, we've talked about this, when you're greenlighting shows or you're moving forward with shows, don't give them one season. It's one of the reasons why I think we've talked also offline about why Korra had so many struggles to a lot of the fandom with Atla when we were talking about, you know, the next thing there. I think you have to commit to giving people a chance. So if they do bring it back for another season, I hope they greenlight it for more than one season so that you can get a more fleshed out view of where they want to take the story. You know, it doesn't feel rushed.
Mm-hmm. So let's just briefly talk about Afrofuturism, because I feel like this was that was heavy in the last episode, especially with Dee and knowing that their son is going to be a sci-fi writer. Mm-hmm. I think that we should acknowledge that the show played very heavily into the idea that Afrofuturism is something that, you know, Black folks are focused on right now and think about and has a place in the culture.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons I think that we're podcasting, right? Is that we wanted to have our voice be part of the conversation around, you know, the greater fandom of like fantasy and sci-fi, but also that sci-fi and fantasy has to have continue to grow in the space of diversity. And I also think that Afrofuturism is making that statement. Like, you know, when you think about, you know, things like Sun Ra and other things that have moved from the past, and even now today, you bring that forward to someone like Janelle Monáe, who actually did a really cool 3D kind of event, virtual reality event based on celebrating the wrapping of the show, and was also like part of science fiction book clubs, like, you know, the South Side Science Fiction Club, before she was a well-known music artist. I think it's really interesting to think about the statement Afrofuturism is making is that, yes, Black people will exist in the future. Like, yes, we are there. We are going to, that just that statement alone isn't something that should be so radical or like, but you see sci-fi has often gravitated towards stories that don't include people of color on a mass scale. So I think like, I love the idea of them wrapping that into this show, and in general, I love exploring those stories. I mean, obviously, somebody like Octavia Butler had been exploring this for a long time, you know.
Yeah, and Sam Delaney, and so like, we have always had a place in sci-fi. We have always had a place in technology advancement. And I think that we can say with confidence that Black people are always a forward-looking culture. That's part of us looking towards the future, to future generations. Mm-hmm. And I love that this show, it makes, you know, Hippolyta makes technological advances in the show and then passes it to her daughter. Mm-hmm. And that clearly Letty passes on her and Tick's love for sci-fi to their son. And so I just think that I found that really beautiful. And just given that like Afrofuturism has become such a big like conversation over the last few years with Black Panther, with the success of N.K. Jemisin and other writers who write about like what would the world look like if we looked at race differently, if we considered it differently, and always has a role for Black people and other people of color in the future. I thought it was really well done.
Yeah.
And I liked that nod to Afrofuturism in the show for sure.
100%. 100%. Well, all right. That'll do it. And we will see you guys next time. You know, we're going to have some more coverage coming up. Possible things that we'll post about this show, and then we're getting ready for our coverage in a couple of weeks of His Dark Materials. So
yes,
excited. So, you know,
ready to see Pan freak out.
I'm always ready for Pan to see Pan freak out.
Every time that Lyra has a challenge, Pan is gonna be shook. So
super hyped for this show. It's coming back. The previews look amazing. We've been like getting ready. So yeah, we look forward to you guys enjoying and the coverage there and interacting with you about that show, and have a good rest of your day.
Yeah. Bye everyone. Thank you so much.